Hola, so please find a comfortable position. We'll go directly to the practice. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. And calm and soothe the mind with mindfulness of breathing, relaxing deeply with every out-breath, releasing tension in the body, releasing thoughts, breath by breath. And with your eyes at least partially open, evenly release your awareness into the space in front of you, but without grounding your attention in any visual object, but just rest your awareness in space with no object, not meditating on anything, just sustaining the flow of mindfulness without distraction, without grasping. Just let your awareness hold its own ground in a stillness that comes from release rather than constriction, a release of all grasping. Direct your awareness up into the space above you as far as your awareness can reach, but without visualizing anything, without any target, any object. Just direct your awareness upward. Then relax. Let your awareness return to its own place. Direct your awareness out into the space to your right. Extend as far as you can out into space. And relax, letting your awareness settle right where it is. Direct your awareness out into the space to the left. Bring it back to center. Direct your awareness down into the mental space beneath you. Of course, not physical space, but the mental space there is boundless. Direct your awareness there without an object. And return to center. Then, if you wish, you may close your eyes. Let your awareness descend to the heart, not looking down at the heart from above, but see if you can so relax, so release all grasping, that you have a sense of actually moving the locus of your awareness to your heart and being present there. release your awareness, release your mind into space with no boundaries. And leave it there in the open expansiveness of space, sustained gently, continuously, the awareness of being aware. Again, sustain that flow of awareness without distraction, without grasping. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Oh, lasso. So the two shamatha methods that we've been exploring over the last week and a half, the settling the mind, the shamatha without a sign, they're both quite notorious for catalyzing karma, catalyzing one's own karma, of course. The Tibetan term is long, eruptions, upheavals. It's not that we're doing something harmful to ourselves. Either, I think it's quite obvious these are not detrimental practices. There's nothing damaging about them. They're so passive, they're so neutral. But by allowing the contents of the mind to flow forth unimpededly in the settling the mind practice, in that process or in this practice, just going right in the nature of awareness, it just turns out to be the case. And this has been known for like at least 1,000 years, that this does tend to bring up habitual propensities, karma, and so forth. It really catalyzes karma. It is a purification. So those of you who have done very intensive Vajrasattva practice, you may find that also really catalyzes karma. It doesn't simply purify karma, it also brings some of the karma up, so you get to deal with it. That happened to me the first time. I've done the Vajrasattva practice 100,000 three times. And the first time, when I came right to the end of it, I had actually worms popping out of my skin. So the purification was rather obvious and disgusting. That doesn't happen very often. I don't know anybody else who's had that particular case. But purification in various kind of variety really does happen a lot. And for these shamatha practices, then there are references in the classic literature to outer, inner, and secret upheavals or eruptions. Outer may catalyze stuff in your environment. Again, because of this total entanglement of subject and object, it can actually catalyze things in the environment that may be very challenging. It can catalyze things in your body in terms of just physical, weird physical stuff coming up. The body, including the energetic body. A lot of people, as you report your experiences to me, are speaking of some rather strange, anomalous movements of energy in the body. Very, very common. And then, of course, it can also occur just in terms of emotions, so the secret, that which is not evident from the outside, but memories, emotions, desires, really stuff getting churned up. And so one should expect the unexpected. And that is upheavals, outer, inner, and secret, are just bound to happen. And there's no homogeneity about it, but it does happen a lot. And in this text that I've referred to a number of times now, the Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, which is the most concise of Dzogchen Lingpa's 5 Dzogchen mind treasures, after having given a very, very precise and very in-depth presentation of settling the mind in its natural state, then he goes right to the upheavals and said, in the course of this, you may really encounter some challenging stuff coming up that you'll regard as obstacles. These are really obstacles to the practice. And then now you've really come to a fork in the road, okay? And one fork, if you just like to get stuck there, is to reify whatever's coming up, grasp onto it, objectify it, grasp onto it as inherently real, and then enter into a whole kind of a cycle of hope and fear and trying this and trying that and really agonizing over how to make it go away, okay? That's one way to do it. Now, I want to hasten to add that if in the course of your meditation some medical condition does arise, then we never abandon common sense. If there's any concern, maybe something medical has arisen, like one of my students while in a strict retreat had appendicitis. He didn't say, just let it be. You know? He would have probably had a very good death, but nevertheless dying a little bit prematurely. And so he did the sensible thing. He went after a doctor, and in fact he needed emergency care. He was really having acute appendicitis. So why wouldn't that happen in retreat? I mean, we're just living, so all kinds of stuff, just medical stuff can come up, not necessarily catalyzed by the meditation anyway, just stuff happens, right? So if it's medical, if one even is concerned that it's medical, by all means, treat it medically. But once you have clarity that whatever's coming up in the body is not a medical condition, and get that from a medical professional, if the professional tells you, I see nothing wrong, I'm not denying you're having some anomalous experiences, but medically, I don't see anything at all, then pay your bill with a great big thank you. Now I don't have to think about that anymore and treat it as a nyam. So Tibetan term, a lot of you know it, some of you don't. But I don't know how to translate it, so I'm going to stick with nyam. But what a nyam is, and it's one of those really strong terms that occurs especially in the Dzogchen literature, is it's an anomalous, so out of the ordinary, transient, they tend to be fleeting, physiological or psychological and or psychosomatic experience that is catalyzed by authentic practice. Not because you're doing something wrong, but because you're doing it right. And it just catalyzes stuff coming up. And we call it nyam or meditative experience. That's rather a bland, vague translation. And so when such anomalous experiences, sometimes bizarre, a bit creepy, sometimes painful, sometimes interesting, sometimes blissful, when these nyam arise, but especially of the kind that we regard as obstacles, then we may then reify them and really get stuck. That's a possibility. Another possibility, though, and this is the one that Dujum Lingba or Tsoke Dorje, the Lake Born Vajra, suggest is now you come to a crossroads here, or to a fork in the road, here's the way out. As you're experiencing whatever's coming up, which is so easily is called an obstacle to your practice, don't reify it. Don't grasp onto it as existing from its own side, as real, inherent, tangible, substantial. Don't do that. Whatever understanding you have of emptiness, use it now. So some of you have studied emptiness, received teachings from geshes and kempos and lamas and so forth. You know, so you will have had some exposure to the middle way view, teachings on emptiness and so forth. It's not enough to study it, not enough to believe it. It's really now to view reality with whatever understanding you have and view these so-called obstacles as being empty of inherent nature, that is, being empty appearances, but with no real power from their own side. They get their power by our grasping onto and reifying them. Just as if, I had a bizarre dream just a couple of nights ago, right at the end of the night. I was walking along by the side of a building, and I saw a cobra, a large cobra, just snaking right along, just and actually still, right next to the wall. And I walked by it, and then for whatever reason, I stopped. I couldn't quite figure out, why would you do that? Why not kind of run, kind of keep on moving, you know? But I didn't. I stopped and let the cobra get around in front of me, and then he was striking, and I was warding him off with my shoe. Like, you know, like a little karate move. Like, and he smacked his mouth into my shoe, and I was ready for his next, you know. And then I woke up. Well, that cobra could conceivably have bitten me and not just get a mouthful of rubber or leather. But if he had any capacity to harm me, the capacity came entirely from my giving it to him. Right? I mean, with the fear there, maybe he bites me in the leg and it really hurts, and maybe I feel the venom coming in and I'm freaking out. Insofar as he experienced any physical pain whatsoever or any psychological pain whatsoever, it's not coming from the side of the cobra, because there's no cobra. It's an empty appearance, right? We're all awake now. I'm telling you about a dream, so we all know there was no cobra. Out there, there are cobras, but not in my dream. And so, can we suffer because of things that happen to us in our dreams? Can we suffer physically? The answer is, yeah, sure. Somebody can punch you and it really hurts. Or a cobra can bite you. Ow. Right? But only because we're reifying it. No other reason. Become lucid. That's your get out of jail free ticket. That's your freedom right there. Don't reify it. Know for what it is. That's an empty appearance. There's no cobra there. And so, clearly, a cobra in a dream and a cobra in the waking state are different. We deal with them differently. But when it's a nyam, that's why I'm being very careful here. We're not going into crazy land here. But when it's a nyam, when you know it's a nyam, when you know it's just something catalyzed by your practice, and it's nothing out there to be really concerned of that needs to be addressed, then treat it as an empty appearance. And treat it without hope or fear. So it's a tall order, but this is his lojong. This is the Lake Born Vajra's lojong. When you encounter obstacles of this sort that are simply catalyzed by your practice, and they don't need to be addressed in the physical world, like a cobra needs to be addressed, a medical condition does need to be addressed, of course, we're commonsensical. But when it's not that, then don't treat it as if it is that, as if it's real, inherent, and so forth and so on, but treat it as an empty appearance and just let it be without hope or fear. Without desire or aversion. Just let it be. Now we can ask technically, let's say for the settling the mind as natural state. You all know what the object is, space of the mind, and whatever arises within it. If something is coming up physically, maybe it's some weird sensations in the body, or whatever it is, and it's a nyam, right? Or maybe there's some outer noise, you know, dog barking or some whatever, some invasive noise. Or even some thought or some memory coming up, or an emotion coming up, right? All of those we could regard as obstacles, right? If you do, you're wrong. The Tibetan term for obstacle is barche, barche. So there's Maria Elena, here am I. And so barche is something that cuts in between. So if I asked Maria Elena to dance with me, and then Rob comes in and said, I want to cut in, which they used to do, I think. I don't know if they still do that anymore, in my day. But if Rob cuts in and said, no, I'd like to dance with Maria Elena, then he becomes a barche for my continuing to dance with Maria Elena. He gets in between, and then he dances with her, and then I'm left out in the cold. Right? That's barche. That's an obstacle. Something cuts in between, right? What exactly can cut in between you and your emotions? If the content, the focus of your mindfulness is the space of the mind and whatever arises, what's to get in between your awareness and the space of your mind and whatever arises? How do sounds get in between? Thoughts, how can they get in between? They're grist for the mill. They're what you're attending to. How can emotions get in between? They're arising in the space of the mind. They're what you're attending to. How can tactile sensations get in between? They're not in between you and your thoughts, you and the space of the mind. So really, technically speaking, there are no barche. There's nothing that can cut in between your awareness and the space of the mind, your awareness and the contents of the mind. How can that happen? It's not a barche. It's a barche only if you think it's a barche. It's an obstacle only if you think it's an obstacle. Let alone if you're practicing shamatha without a sign. You're resting in awareness of awareness. What exactly is going to get between you and your awareness that says, I'm sorry, but like a Rob coming in and saying, I'm sorry, I want to cut in. I want to dance with Maria Elena. How does something cut in between you and your awareness of which you are aware and saying, I'm sorry, I'm bumping you out because I want to dance with your awareness? How is that possible? That was a rhetorical question. Not possible. So for these practices, if we really look at bodhicitta as obstacle, something that cuts in between, gets in between, obstructs us from attending to the object, it's not even possible. Except for it's possible if we think it's possible, and then we grasp onto it, reify it, we screw ourselves up. So Lakeborn Vajra concludes on this point, that if you grasp onto it, reify, then you can really get yourself stuck indefinitely. Whereas if you do this, just don't reify it. He quotes Aryadeva, and saying, you don't need to counteract the appearances, they're empty. So there's no reason to try to make them go away. They're empty. Let them be. That was a paraphrase, but a close one. And by letting them be without hope or fear, in that response, then these nyam, these so-called obstacles, will vanish of their own accord, and in so doing, they'll actually empower your practice. So it's very powerful. It's very tough, there's no question about it. And if one has no understanding at all of emptiness, of the lack of inherent nature of phenomena, no understanding of how phenomena arise relative to and independence upon our conceptual designation, if you think they're already out there in and of themselves, then you can't do that. And you may have a lot of obstacles, right? So that's a rather important point. It's actually a crucial point, and it relates to this last aphorism pertaining to the cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta. So let's go there. Tunsam gyume kyeburja, says in Tibetan. Tunsam gyume kyeburja. There we are. Between sessions, act as an illusory being. Act as an illusory being. So we see a certain symmetry here. And that is the very first aphorism pertaining to the cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta was Chuna Milam Taburta, view phenomena as if they were dreams. Right? That's how it started. By really looking into Pratityasamutpada, the manner in which all phenomena, subjective and objective, arise as dependently related events appearing to exist from their own side, concrete, objective, real, exactly as they do in a dream. Like that cobra I saw really looked like it was totally there. Black. He looked rather malevolent. You know? That's what he looked like. And he was over there. I could see him. And then I felt him when his face smacked into the sole of my shoe. You know, oh, wow, he's got a punch. They appear to be from their own side, and yet they aren't. So viewing all phenomena, although they appear to be from their own side, they are not, therefore they are like dreams. So that's where he started. And then we go through the succession, which I interpreted clearly in the context of Dzogchen. That's only one of multiple ways of interpreting it, but I think it's the most meaningful one I could give. Therefore, I gave the best I could give and not anything less. And now we come to the conclusion of this set of aphorisms pertaining to ultimate bodhicitta. And he says, between sessions, so now he's finished talking about what do you do when you're on the cushion while in meditative equipoise? Been there, done that, right? And now we go to, okay, what about all that time in between sessions? Even the great yogis, pretty much, they do have time in between sessions. You know, they have time to drink some water, have some tea, go for a walk, etc. He says, act as if you're an illusory being. Act as if your very presence in the world were an apparition. That you appear, you can shake hands with people, people see you, you can hear your voice, you can touch things, engage. But in terms of there being something substantial here, inherent, physically real, inherently real, banish that and replace that view with the notion of your being like an apparition. Appear to be there, but not really there from your own side. Another way of viewing this, he doesn't say this in the text, but I've heard this elsewhere. In between sessions, act as if you were a bardo being, you'd already died, and yet you're physically present. I mean, the teachings on the bardo say that you, especially during the first week when you're in the bardo, kind of a fresh bardo baby, you will appear to yourself as having a form very similar to the one you had in your past life. Very, very similar. But of course, it's purely mind-made, just like in a dream. You can move, unlike in the waking state or ordinary living state, you can move at the speed of thought, just like in a dream. You can be here, and then you think someplace else, and you're immediately there. You travel faster than the speed of light. And the remarkable thing is that you actually can perceive events in this intersubjective world that you and I experience. That kind of boggles the mind. But this is the assertion. And so you're seeing, you're hearing other people, and these are actual people. You can also see their thoughts. You're clairvoyant. But they can't see you. You're a ghost. Unless they're clairvoyant, they can't see you. And you're already dead, so you better give up all your attachment to this life because it isn't there anymore. So there you are. You're perceiving, but you're not really there. So something like that, this giving up all attachment to this life. So Padmasambhava comments in this regard, consider that since these things which are without permanence, these things in our waking state, while alive, these things are without permanence. There's nothing here that is enduring, nothing stable. They're without stability or immutability. Since these are without, they have no inherent nature. Although they certainly appear to, they are like illusions. So there's a statement. Actually, this runs through all the teachings of the Buddha, from the Pali Canon, right on through Mahayana, through Vajrayana, through Dzogchen, this recurrent theme that things are not as they appear. Now, we hear this from modern science as well, but frankly, I think it's a deeper meaning here in Buddhism because it's fully taking into account the role of consciousness in the world. And so in this regard, as we view our own bodies as illusory, reviewing the body as a matrix of dependently related events that arise independent upon causes and conditions, but amongst them is the role of conceptual designation without which they are not there. So there is no real body, no real mind, no real person that exists inherently independently of conceptual designation. There's the theme. So I won't try to elaborate on this. We're coming to the end of these teachings on ultimate bodhicitta, but what he's suggesting here is whatever understanding you have of the teachings on emptiness, then apply them here, apply them in between sessions to release the reification that we have of objects, of subjects, but especially our own presence and activities within the world. And especially when it comes to the so-called eight mundane concerns. And that is the material acquisition and loss, the experience of hedonic pleasure, hedonic pain, being praised, being ridiculed, having good reputation, losing one's good reputation, having a terrible reputation. These things, when we're immersed in the pursuit of hedonic well-being, these are like the most important things they are. Or what I like to call the three jewels of the hedonic pursuit is wealth and everything wealth can get. You can get with wealth, money, and power, and everything you can do with power, and reputation, prestige, status, and everything you can do with that. And that kind of, I think that pretty well sums it up for the pursuit of hedonic pleasure, really hoping that samsara is going to work out well. I think it kind of boils down to those, or the classic Buddhist classification is of these eight mundane concerns, which is pretty inclusive as well. And when we fixate on them, when we grasp onto them with attachment or aversion, the loss of our material goods, getting ridiculed, losing reputation, and so forth, when we're immersed in them with craving and attachment or strong, powerful aversion and anger, in all of those cases, in the Buddhist understanding, that craving and hostility, that craving and powerful aversion or aggression is always based upon the reification of those objects. It always is. And then we're stuck. Then we just go around and around. And so to undermine that whole cycle is to realize the emptiness as much as we can, to view the emptiness, make it real, actually view one more revolution. Beyond the four thoughts that turn the mind, here's a fifth one. View things differently. View things as being empty appearances, having causal efficacy. So if you see an actual cobra out there, treat it as a cobra. It's not inherently existent, but it can non-inherently bite you and you'll non-inherently die. Causal efficacy, of course, still plays. But of course, it does in a dream as well. And that is, if a cobra bites you in a dream, it still hurts and you may actually die. Years ago, I was in a dream, and like in the movie regarding Henry, I think it was called, with Harrison Ford, long time ago. But he was in a little 7-Eleven kind of place, a little grocery store. And somebody came in and just shot him right in the head. And he then didn't die. But he had certainly a major shift in his life. And so in a dream of mine a long time ago, somebody came and shot me in the head and I died, you know, in the dream. And it can happen, you know. And you wake up, you still wake up, oh, last night I died. So there's causality. Somebody shoots a gun and you're dead in a dream. Cobra bites you, it really hurts. You may die of the wound, or you may get, you know, start freaking out and so forth. So there's causality in a dream, even though there's nothing inherently there, subjectively or objectively. There's causality in the waking state, even though, according to this Madhyamaka view, there's nothing more inherently existent in the waking state than in the dream state. That's a real clincher. Quite in a statement. That is a revolutionary statement. So this is the impure illusory body. The impure illusory. So you're still identifying with your ordinary form, your ordinary sense of identity, but just not reifying it. You're still a sentient being. You still have mental afflictions, obscurations. You're still right there in the first noble truth of suffering, the second noble truth of the causes of suffering, but you're just not reifying it. Right. So you haven't really fundamentally shifted your sense of identity, except you're no longer reifying it. That's the impure, illusory body. Right? So the form is the same. The content, in terms of something being substantially, inherently real, that's been released. Now, we'll shift over here to what is called the pure illusory body. For those of you who've had some exposure, maybe some of you have had a lot of exposure, to Vajrayana teachings, then you know in the context of Vajrayana, the practice is, number one, you must have some realization of emptiness, at least some understanding, otherwise you really can't do it at all. It becomes just a sham, kind of something silly. But if whatever understanding you have, or realization, better, insight into emptiness, you bring that to bear, and in your mind's eye, you dissolve your entire environment and your body, your mind, and your very sense of personal identity, who you are. You dissolve all of that into Dhamma Dhatu, absolute space of phenomena. By realizing the absence of inherent nature, realizing that, and then with that realization, simply withdrawing the conceptual designation. And then imagining, this is done in virtual reality by the power of imagination, you imagine all phenomena then dissolving into the absolute space of phenomena, or Dhamma Dhatu. So now you're kind of resting in, your awareness non-dual from that, you're resting in an open space of pure potential. Pure potential. Because there's no actuality there at all. There's no this and that. It's just a field of emptiness, but it's not a mere nothing. Not a mere nothing, right? And then out of emptiness, then you bring forth, perhaps from a seed syllable, your own presence, your own body, your own mind, your own identity, but now bringing forth a sense of divine pride, identifying with one of the manifestations of Buddha, let's say Tara. You arise as Tara, or let's say better yet, Avalokiteshvara, embodiment of compassion, right? Classic practice. And what the only one that I've seen, according to Kamachame Rinpoche, one of the great 17th century Gagyu Nyingma masters, he really emphasizes this one, as all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism do. Genrezi, Avalokiteshvara. And says, here's a practice where you can do the self-generation. That is, you dissolve your ordinary sense of identity into emptiness, out of emptiness, from the syllable hri. You transform from the seed syllable into your own form, but manifesting as Padmasambhava, as Avalokiteshvara. You really assume this archetypal form and the identity of being Avalokiteshvara. And he said, this practice, you don't really need empowerment. It's nice to have empowerment, very good, but you don't need it. This one, this is mangchu, he says. Mangchu, this is public dharma. There's no danger. If you do this, it won't hurt you. You don't have to worry. So get an empowerment, very good. If not, go ahead and practice anyway. It's really good. You've dissolved your ordinary sense of identity. You arise with divine pride, identifying with Avalokiteshvara. I am Avalokiteshvara. Here's my archetypal form, surrounded by pure vision. Your environment, everybody in it, viewing this with the power of imagination, of course, from the perspective of Avalokiteshvara's own mind. So the form you've taken now is a pure illusory body, like the four-armed Avalokiteshvara, for example. And then you seek to sustain that with the power of imagination, imagining, viewing reality from the perspective of one who is enlightened and has pure vision in all directions. That's pure. Now, here's the classic approach of stage regeneration. Okay. Beyond that is stage of completion. In the stage of regeneration, you're imagining being a Buddha, and imagining performing the deeds of a Buddha, imagining your environment being a Buddha field, and all the beings within it being manifestations of enlightenment. So this is a developmental approach. And then when it's over, then you dissolve this, and then you may try to maintain that pure vision in between sessions, which is what is advised here. Or many people say, okay, I just finished doing my sadhana, and I need to go to work. Go to the insurance office and deal with my clients, you know? And if you try to see them pure, that might be a bit challenging. So from this perspective, this adopting of this illusory body is approaching this from the perspective that, well, you are, after all, a sentient being. But as skillful means, you will override that by the power of imagination and faith. You'll override that and adopt, with the power of imagination, the sense of identity of being a Buddha, of Avalokiteshvara. But in the back of your mind, there's still that sense, well, of course, I'm a sentient being doing this practice. In the back of your mind, there is a sense, I'm a sentient being. And I have a Buddha nature. And I'm going to use this skillful means of stage regeneration to draw forth the power of that Buddha nature so I can actually actualize it. Remember the parable, I hope it's quite memorable, of the Prince Kirana in his wandering around as a beggar, finally, after years, coming to the home of the minister, right? And begging, and the minister immediately recognizing him as the prince and trying to persuade him that he is a prince. And he resists it at first, you remember? He resists it, saying, you know, I'm not a prince, I'm a beggar. Well, this stage of generation approach would be like the minister saying, well, okay, I understand that you're a beggar, but humor me. Recognize, just for starters, that when you look within yourself, you can't see anything that's intrinsically a beggar. You look for that. You see rags, but that doesn't mean you can wear rags without being a beggar. And you have a sense of being a beggar, but that's just because you have a sense of being a beggar. But you're not intrinsically a beggar. So please realize that you're not inherently a homeless person, a beggar. Realize that. Now realizing that, now humor me. I would just like you. So imagine the minister gets to hold on to him for a while. So like, but do check this out. You can't remember your childhood as a beggar. You can't remember your parents as a beggar. You can't remember where you were born, your upbringing. You can't remember any of that. You look in within yourself. You can't find a beggar. So you might want to give that a rest. Maybe you're not inherently a beggar. I know conventionally, okay. But now humor me. Now that you have some sense that you're not inherently, intrinsically, absolutely a homeless beggar, humor me. Put on these clothes, these princely clothes, and imagine you're a prince. Just imagine. Just play, you know, play along. Imagine you're a prince. Come in, Your Highness, or Your Excellency, whatever they call a prince. Come in. Let me bring you to the dining hall and enjoy the royal feast. And here come your subjects. Humor me. Pretend as if you're the prince and responding to your subjects and so forth. And here's the throne. Well, humor me. Sit on the throne and, you know, perform the various deeds of a prince. I know, you know, you don't think you're a prince. I know that, but go along with this. And tell, you just do that long enough. And just as much as you can, continuously abandon that grasping onto, I'm a bum. Go along with me. You're not inherently a bum, so go along with me. And try it as continuously as possible to view the surroundings as being that of a palace, and the garb being the royal garb, and your identity being actually a prince. Humor me. Pretend. And pretend long enough. And then you see this resonance between what you're pretending and what you actually were in the first place. And what you were in the first place, you actually are a prince, then becomes manifest. And then it dawns on you, oh my goodness, I've been pretending to be who I am. And I don't need to pretend anymore. Skillful means, where you regard your Buddha nature as something you have, which one day you hope to realize. There's one approach, the developmental approach. But as His Holiness has pointed out, the Dalai Lama has pointed out, the Dzogchen approach is somewhat different. It's a complementary. It's not competing. It's not like who wins, who's right, who's wrong. Let's debate about it, and one defeats the other. It's not that way. Or at least it doesn't have to be that way. And according to His Holiness, that's not the fruitful way to approach it. The other approach is to just release entirely even your conventional sense, even the relative sense, even the conceptually designated sense of being a sentient being. But rather that regard that identity of you are this person from Australia, you're this person from Italy and so forth, that whole identity, and you have mental afflictions, you have your personal history, and you have your suffering and your obscurations and all the whole story, regard that as something you have, that you can pick up and take off like a set of clothes. But who you are is Buddha. Who you are is Rigpa. And release everything else, even the conventional sense, the relative sense of being a sentient being. Release it all. Release all the identification, all the grasping of yourself as a sentient being within samsara. Release it all. None of it was you anyway. So why don't you just release it all and then see what's left when you utterly relinquish all grasping, all identification. You'll just let your awareness rest in its own place. And the deeper you rest, the more subtle you release and release and release all grasping until you release even the grasping to the bliss, the luminosity, and the non-conceptuality of your substrate consciousness. All grasping, all identification, all preference. Even to that, you develop a truly Teflon awareness and you slip through. You break through even your substrate consciousness. You break through to Rigpa. Without imagining anything, without imagining you're a Buddha, imagining all sounds are the Buddha speech, all thoughts are Buddha mind, all appearances Buddha body, without imagining anything, you just release 100% all the way through until you've released the last vestige of yourself as being a sentient being, of your mind as something distinct, individuated, and release into Rigpa, which is open, undifferentiated. So that's another approach. One says you have a Buddha nature. The other one says you are a Buddha nature. One entails you must do something to realize that Buddha nature. The other one says you must stop doing everything that it's impeding your realization of who you already are. So, in either way, regard yourself yourself as this sentient being with your personal history and so forth. Either way you do it, regard yourself as an illusory being. In vernacular, don't take yourself too seriously. So, in this regard, I'll come back to the aphorism, which I find I get a lot of mileage out of this, so many usages, because it's applicable in so many different ways. For the moment, what you attend to is reality. William James. For the moment, what you attend to is reality. If we're constantly, internally, attending to our mental afflictions, our suffering, our problems, our ruminations, the body, the pains in the body, and so forth, that's what we're attending to? That's what you're going to regard as real. It's already signed, sealed, and delivered. That is going to be the way it is, because that's what you're attending to. You know? And likewise, as we attend to, now this is whether we're here in Phuket or we're back working eight-hour days wherever we live, you know, in a regular job, engaging with our families and so forth. If we make it a habit to be attending to others' defects, their flaws, and so forth, that's what will be real for us. If we reify those around us as being just sentient beings, absolutely, inherently, that's the way it is, you're just a sentient being, that's what will be real for us. That's what we're grasping onto. And the whole spirit of the Lojong teachings is that reality is not just given. It's not just presented to us, packaged, complete, like it or lump it. Like, you know, like a football thrown into your stomach. Like that. Reality is not like that. It's not simply objectively given any more than we're subjectively given, that we just simply are the way we are because we're really that way. But it's in a constant state from moment to moment, just sheer potential. From moment to moment, sheer potential. You know, with nothing already inherently real. We see this from quantum cosmology. Even the past is not already carved in granite. Even the past has not absolutely happened in one particular way, because past is always viewed by somebody. And it's not in an absolute way, it's always a relative way, right? So likewise for the present, that from moment to moment, it's just an ocean of possibility. In Buddhism, they speak of sipatamche. Sipatamche means all possible worlds, as referring to just everything. Sipatamche, plural though, tamche, all of them. And the word sipal actually does mean to be becoming, that is, it hasn't already become, it's not already locked in and solid, but it also... And I don't know, I think this is a strong correlation. If I'm wrong, please do tell me. But Yongs, in Tibetan colloquially, you say, Karasa, so, Kamila, Dogong, Cham Cham, Do Sigaret. It's possible that Kamila will go for a walk. Yongs, Do Sigaret. The same word. So, my sense of it is really the same word. It's not one word that has entirely different meanings. It's becoming, which means. It's within the realm of possibility. It hasn't already concretized. And so when saying sipatamjit, it's all possible worlds, right? And then how does it become actual relative to our attention, what we're attending to, and that not only what we're attending to, but how we attend to it, right? And then how we're attending to it relates to how we conceptually designate it. By the time it gets to conceptual designation, that's where the probability function collapses. And you have an actuality. Oh, this was such a tragedy. This was such a hassle. This was such good luck. This was so boring. This was, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was made flesh. The Word makes things substantial. That's from the New Testament, right? Resonance all over the place. It's the Word. Same thing in Genesis. Word. God spoke the world into the universe. Maybe that's not all silly. So there it is, but not in the Buddhist view, not one universe that somebody else did to us, but this ongoing flow of possibility for which we are concretizing, actualizing worlds, relating to how we attend to, how we conceptually designate. So this whole Lojong practice, we're ending now quite quickly. the cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta and going into this relative bodhicitta. But all the way through, it's now having started with the wisdom teachings, just showing, emphasizing here, here's how we start. Things are not absolutely given. They're arising relative to your way of viewing, the way of designating, labeling, conceiving. And therefore, since it's a dance, since it's an entanglement, this means you're not simply, or you don't need to be, simply a helpless victim of circumstances. Because how you experience it is not just shifting your perspective. It's not just shifting your subjective mode. You're shifting the whole entanglement. You're shifting the whole system. By shifting the subjective, you're also shifting the objective from your perspective. This is why when like this text, Didu Lamkhir, transforming Didu literally means happiness and sadness, happiness and suffering, into the spiritual path. Classic text by a Dzogchen master, Dodubchen. But I don't translate it. My own preference, it's my preference as a translator, is not to translate it as transforming happiness and sadness into the spiritual path. Because that would imply that you're just transforming the subjective part. Are you happy about this? Or are you unhappy about this? Well, whichever way, transform that into spiritual practice, right? I think it goes much deeper than that. Much, much deeper. And that's why I translate it as transforming felicity and adversity. Because felicity refers to the situation, the whole bandwidth, the subject-object system. Here's the subject over here, the object over there, but it's a system. And this we're experiencing, this system, this situation, where I'm part of the situation, there's part of the situation, but it's a situation. The whole situation is being transformed. You really are an alchemist, not only of your mind, but what not only of the experiencer, but what you're experiencing. Right? That's really core to Lojong, all the way through, right up to Dzogchen Lojong, Majjhimaka Lojong, and then the Lojong of the seven-point mind training. You're transmuting the entire system, the whole experience. You're transmitting what you experience and not only the way you experience it. So, in this regard, from sheer intelligence, just using prajna, intelligence, is a good translation, and it also means wisdom, then one can really approach and gain some deep insight into the teachings on emptiness. You can approach it from multiple perspectives. So you can just approach it straight from Buddhist philosophy, the meditation way of life. You don't need science. People have been practicing Majjhimaka for 2,000 years or so without any references to quantum mechanics or anything like that. And that is quite sufficient. And then through that, by utilizing your intelligence and investigating, as I said, Tibetan monks in the great monastic universities will spend 4 years just studying Majjhimaka and debating it. When Geshe Rabten told me of his training and studying Majjhimaka, it was just awesome. I mean, often the debates would go on all night until the sun came up. You know, that's the depth of kind of the investigation, the testing, and the debating is really to probe and to test to overcome this massive, overwhelming impression that everything is real. It's inherently existent. It's already out there. Hey, we're not dreaming here. We're awake, and this is real. And so the evidence seems to be overwhelming that Majjhimaka is wrong, right? And so much of science would say, no, it's absolutely real. The world is, what's really out there is the physical, like it or lump it. That's what's really inherently absolutely happening. So we get it from modernity. We get it from just the sense appearances. And so that's a mammoth task to really look through all of that, not with a leap of faith, but by investigating, is anything really found upon careful analysis, investigation? Is there really evidence that something is there from its own side, or is it all relational and relative to conceptual designation? So they'll literally study that for 4 years. In the Nyingma tradition, good 2 years at least. You know? So intelligence would get that far, where taking the analogy again of being inside a non-lucid dream, but a lucid dream goes on for 4 years, and during those 4 years, every day, hour upon hour upon hour, every day, you're studying, you're reflecting, you're debating, you're meditating on, are these appearances of yourself in the dream? You don't know it's a dream. It's a non-lucid dream. But of your own presence, your own identity, everybody you meet, the whole environment, inherently existent or not? Inherently existent or not? So imagine a dream goes for 4 years, continuous dream. And through those 4 years, you come to really deep insight. That it's just so sharp. It's irreversible. It's one of those revolutions. When I was receiving Geshe Rabten's autobiography, it arose by question and answer. I posed questions to him, primarily about his monastic training. And finally, we got to the 6 years that he was in retreat in that little hut up above McLeod Gunge. And he told me, as a consummate geshe, he was a superb scholar, outstanding debater. So he was really professionally trained. And then he could have had pretty much any position. I mean, he was such an accomplished geshe. If he wanted to kind of climb the hierarchy, there's a lot of hierarchy in Tibetan Buddhism, and become an abbot here and an abbot there and go on. The sky was the limit. He could have really done anything. He was brilliant. But after he finished his geshe training, got his PhD, so to speak, after 24 years of training, then he recognized, and this so spoke to my heart, he's now, what would he be, well into his 40s. He just thought, he said, most of my teachers have now passed away. How can I repay their kindness? And he thought there's only one way, and that is just to devote the rest of my life to putting those teachings into practice. That's the only way I can repay the kindness. So he just abandoned he could have had a very comfortable life. He was accomplished. He became a secondary tutor for the Dalai Lama. He was renowned, outstanding teacher also. Not all the geishas are great teachers. He was really an outstanding teacher, and people knew that. And he left it all behind. He released all of it and just went into this little Neanderthal hut. It was really primitive. Dirt floor, stones for walls, branches for rafters, and slates, and no water, no electricity, no plumbing, nothing. And he lived there for 6 years. Right? And that's where I met him. He was the hippie lama, because His Holiness asked him to teach us Westerners. And so we went through his whole life story until we were up to where he was living in retreat there, with me pestering him once in a while when he'd give me some time and I could ask him questions about his life. And he said in the course of his meditations, he said he was meditating on the lack of inherent nature of this one tree trunk that held up, that was the central pillar that held up the roof. It was right in the center of the room. Tree trunk. And he would be sitting there on the meditation cushion and applying ontological analysis to the tree trunk holding up the roof until he really had some insight. It's not there. Not from his own side. And he said, I won't talk about it anymore. Because if I speak about it anymore, because he knew that I was writing this in English and it was for the sake of publication. I'd asked him, and his Holiness said, yeah, go for it. Answer the questions of this young guy. So he knew this was going out to the West. And he said, but I'm not going to talk it anymore. Because if I do, you'll think I'm completely crazy. So just let it be. It's okay. You know. So his insight was so deep, I'm persuaded, that it was irreversible. When you see it, and he had done those 4 years, and he meditated another 6 years on top of that, a lot of it really this Madhyamaka, Vipassana, insight practice, authentic Vipassana practice, that is one more revolution, and this is deeper than the other four. And those four were doozies. They were really quite something, weren't they? Precious human rebirth and so forth. This one's even deeper. And when you get it, you can't go back. You can't believe that everything is really inherently real, because you know otherwise. And it doesn't matter whatever, even a thousand voices say, oh, you're completely crazy. You need to go to an insane asylum. You need to be institutionalized. You need antipsychotic medication. You just smile. So it's one more revolution. You can get there with intelligence. You can get there with intelligence. You don't need blind faith. You don't need to have a leap of faith, anything like that. Just investigate deeply. It was really intense. One had to have tremendous determination to engage in the kind of training he was. I was awestruck when I saw the intensity of that training, especially the 4 years of Madhyamaka. I said, wow, I've never heard of such an education like that. That was so demanding. So it took such total commitment. It was really quite awesome. I'd never heard of anything like it. And I thought, whoa, I'd like some of that. That was really kind of a cliché. I think I want to become a monk. I'd like whatever he's got, I like some of that. And so that you can get with intelligence. The better intelligence you have, the better it will work. But in terms of the other one, this Dzogchen approach, it never insults your intelligence. There's nothing unintelligent. There's nothing irrational about the Dzogchen view, the meditation way of life. Nothing ever insults the intelligence. It doesn't confound the intelligence. but it does transcend the intelligence. Because you don't get to it just by thinking really hard and investigating and analyzing and debating and so forth. It's not the way it happens. You can do that, and that will give good intellectual understanding. But actually, to go beyond intellectual understanding, so that you're actually viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa, that calls not on intelligence, but on, not on shirap, but on yeshe. And yeshe is primordial consciousness. So there are four aphorisms in this tradition, the Kadampa tradition it's called, the authentic Kadampa tradition, tracing back to Atisha, without contamination since then. And these are really powerful, really very timely for the 21st century. And the set of aphorisms goes, don't rely upon the individual, rely upon the Dharma. So between the two, you have a teacher. If you have a teacher, you have a teacher. And that's a person. But then there's the teachings. If the teaching are authentic, well then it's Dharma. It's authentic Dharma that's being transmitted. Between the two, where should be your primary reliance? What do you really bank on? What do you really rely upon? The teacher as a person or the Dharma? He said, between those two, rely on the Dharma. That's your real refuge. Teachers come and go. Teachers die. Sometimes teachers screw up. Happens. But the Dharma is your refuge. And then in terms of Dharma, or siklamadun, dunladun, don't rely upon the words. Don't take that as your final resort. Rely upon the meaning. But that means you have to not only hear the teaching, you really have to investigate. What are these words referring to? What's this really all about? Don't get hung up on literal interpretations, always clinging to the words. Go for the referent of the word, the meaning, and rely upon that. And then, don't rely upon the provisional meaning, the contextual meaning, the provisional meaning. Rely upon the definitive meaning. Really go to the core of it. What's really meant? And then finally, the last one's interesting. It's yishe lamadun, yishe ledun. Don't rely upon your mental consciousness. Rely upon primordial consciousness. Yishe lamadun, yishe ledun. So what's that primordial consciousness? If you don't know what it is, how can you rely on it? You know? And I would suggest that experientially, before we are accomplished Dzogchen practitioners, I think the closest word in English is intuition. That's my sense of it. I'm sure it's debatable. But it's not simply intellect. Intellect has a very important role in so many aspects of life. But that the intellect is lodged in mental consciousness. But he's saying yeshe. Ye means primordial. She is knowing, primordial consciousness. And so for Dzogchen, you use your intelligence to be sure. But in order really to fathom the Dzogchen view, to actually view reality from the perspective of Rigpa, you have to kind of break through even mental consciousness, break through to primordial consciousness, and that's your ultimate refuge. That's what you ultimately rely upon. And in Dzogchen teachings altogether, in terms of taking refuge, you can take refuge in the historical Buddha. You can take refuge in an archetypal Buddha like Manjushri. You can take refuge in your guru like His Holiness Dalai Lama. You can take refuge in many things. But ultimately in Dzogchen, your refuge, finally, ultimately, is your own pristine awareness. That's your ultimate refuge. Classic teachings from Dzogchen. And so then it's a fusion, as you see in the notes here, a fusion of intelligence with spiritual intuition, primordial wisdom, primordial consciousness, the union of those two. Because you're not just forsaking intelligence. If you're a Nyingma monk or a nun and you go through 12, 14 years of training as a Kempo, you certainly use your intelligence. It definitely calls on your intelligence as much as you've got. But it calls on more. It calls also on intuition when you're really venturing into Dzogchen practice. It calls on intuition or this primordial consciousness and then the combination of those two. For that which can be conceived, understood on a relative level, you use intelligence. For that which is beyond all conceptual frameworks, even beyond the conceptual framework of existence versus non-existence, which Rigpa does transcend, for that you rely upon another mode of knowing, which is primordial consciousness. So the two together. So the theme here, we're almost finished. In between sessions, act as an illusory being. If we wanted to use an analogy for this, it would be that during the waking state, when you know you're awake, you're not somewhere lying asleep in bed, in between sessions, act as if you were in a lucid dream. Act as if you were in a lucid dream. So everything appearing around you, appearing to be real, but view it as if it's a dream. So that would be the intelligence approach, to view things as if a dream and view yourself as if you were an illusory being. But the Dzogchen approach, and there's a strong shift of terminology. We see this, I think I quoted it. Yeah, from Dzogchen, this is Padmasambhava. All things appear, Phuket, the mind center, our fellow retreatants here, the teacher, the cafeteria, and so forth, everything appears but is non-existent. Everything appears but is non-existent. That's a statement you don't find in Tsongkhapa. At least I've never seen it, nowhere. In the developmental approach, the straight Madhyamaka approach, I've never seen that. Phenomena do not inherently exist. They appear as if they were dreams. Right? Whereas you shift over in the Dzogchen, which is another perspective, is saying these things appear, but they are non-existent. They don't even say conventionally, they say they're non-existent. They don't say in Dzogchen, view this as if it were a dream, but rather, this is a dream. You've already done a Stephen LeBerge state check. You pull your nose, the nose doesn't get longer. You jump, you come thumping down. So you're persuaded beyond any shadow of a doubt that you don't have a body lying someplace in bed, sound asleep. You're quite convinced of that. You've done the test and it came out negative. You're not dreaming. Now that you've ascertained that, now view this reality as a dream. So is kind of this self-induced conscious psychosis? Because a person who cannot distinguish between dream and waking is in serious trouble, right? So what is this? Is Padmasambhava encouraging psychosis here? When you know you're not dreaming, and then you turn right around having done your state checks, and you say, this is a dream. Well, no, he's not psychotic, not encouraging psychosis. He is encouraging a radical shift of perspective. A shift of perspective, instead of viewing reality from your perspective as even a conventionally existent sentient being, which has its reality, but choosing not to view reality from the perspective of conventionally or relatively being a sentient being, you say, I see that's only one option. There's only one option. Relatively speaking, am I a sentient being? Yes, the answer is end of discussion. Relatively speaking, is this person a Buddha or a sentient being? Sentient being, no debate. Is that the only valid perspective? Let's take the Uttara Tantra, one of the five works of Maitreya, Sutrayana, teachings according to the Dzogchen of the third turning wheel of Dharma, teachings on Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. And three themes come out of this, three central themes about Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. The first of these is that the Dharmakaya, the mind, the consciousness of a Buddha, saturates all of existence. Everything that exists, Dharmakaya pervades it, and that means Dharmakaya, Buddha mind, pervades the mind streams of every sentient being. In other words, we're not walled off. I'm sorry, but I'm an inherently existent sentient being. I got myself a little crummy samsaric mind here, and then the Buddha mind just flows around me because I'm intrinsically cruddy. There's no such wall. There's no such wall of insisting, of isolating ourselves from the environment where I'm an absolutely intrinsically a sentient being. There's no such wall. My mind, I'm quite persuaded it's the mind of a sentient being. Anybody's mind, that of a cockroach, a cocker spaniel, is saturated, permeated by Dharmakaya. Where that person's mind is, there is Dharmakaya. Not saying they're the same thing, but they are saying that Dharmakaya saturates the mind stream of every sentient being. So there's the first theme. Where your mind is, there is Dharmakaya. There's the second one. There's the first one. The second one is that the Buddha mind, Dharmakaya, is not inherently separate from or distinct from the minds of sentient beings. It's not saying they're the same, but they're not absolutely separate. They're not absolutely inherently distinct. The distinction is conventional. It's relative. And the third one is that all sentient beings have the potential to achieve perfect enlightenment. That's straight Sutrayana, common to all of Mahayana. So now we take this home. We kind of, okay, here I am. I'm one of those sentient beings. I've got a mind stream. And right where my mind stream is, right where every one of my thoughts is, exactly where my thoughts are, and my emotions, and my mental afflictions, and my virtues, my memories, desires, right where my mind is, right there in every single thought, every emotion, every mental affliction, every virtue, right there, if they're all saturated by Buddha mind, by Dharmakaya, straight Mahayana teaching. So if wherever, whatever thought arises in my mind, even little nasty ones, self-centered ones and so forth, if even they are saturated by Buddha nature, by Buddha mind, maybe I have a choice. Maybe I don't have to identify, maybe I don't have to designate myself. Who is Alan Wallace? Maybe I don't have to designate myself on the basis of my mental afflictions, my ordinary mind, my dualistic mind, and my crummy body here produced by karma and klesha. It's a possibility, but it's not intrinsically me. There's no intrinsic person in the body or the brain. There's no intrinsic person in a thought, a stream of consciousness, and so forth. Since there's no one there anyway, intrinsically, inherently, and since wherever my body is, wherever my speech is, wherever my mind is, and all my thoughts, wherever any of those are, there's also Buddha nature. There's also Buddha mind. Then maybe I'm not compelled by reality to take my ordinary body, speech, and mind as the basis of designation for me. That is clearly a valid way of doing things. If you ask me, Alan, are you a sentient being? I'd say yes, and that's a true statement. The question is it the only true statement? Or is there another truth that is also a possibility that sometimes eludes our attention because we're not attending to it? And that is, instead of taking my ordinary body, speech, and mind as a basis of designation for me, why couldn't I take Dharmakaya that permeates my whole being as a basis of designation, and on the basis of that, say, I am Buddha. My mind is Rigpa. And it's never been anything other than Rigpa. And view Buddha nature not as something that you have, but something that you are. Not as a potential, but as an actuality. So from that perspective, this is a dream. As the Buddha said, I am not a man, I'm awake. He's released even the conventional identification of himself as being a man. Released that, and just settled in his essence, I'm awake. That's all you need to know. I'm not a man as you think you are a man. I'm not that. You're not lucid. You're not awake. I'm awake. That's the difference between the two. Or as they say in Dzogchen, I know who I am. You don't. Because you're locked into the notion that there's only one valid way of perceiving yourself, identifying, apprehending yourself, and that's as a sentient being. And whether or not you reify it, still thinking, but that's the whole of me. That's all there is of me. And all I have beyond that is a potential to be somebody I'm not now, namely a Buddha. Because I have a Buddha nature. That's one valid way. And then you may go through the whole thing of being the prince, donning the beggar, taking, pretending, imagining to be a prince and putting on the princely garb and so forth and so on until it finally breaks through that you don't have to pretend anymore, right? That's the roundabout way. In Dzogchen, it's called the Juma. That's the contrived way, the artificial way, the fabricated way of pretending this, imagining this and so forth, all as skillful means. He said, that's all very well, but it's kind of roundabout. Why don't you just cut through it right now? And recognize that you can release entirely even the conventional sense of being the beggar. And see who you were before you adopted the identity of being a beggar. And who you were before, have been, and will be, is a prince. So that's another way of viewing, understanding this aphorism in between sessions. Act as an illusory being. With impure body, okay, then that's Madhyamaka. As if this were a dream, as if you were an illusion, because seeing things being empty of inherent nature. Pure illusory body, using your power of imagination, like the beggar imagining he's a prince, or just cut right through it, and view this, this is a dream. From the perspective of waking consciousness, from the perspective of a Buddha, this is a dream. This is why it's not psychosis. If you're viewing this from the context of being a sentient being, and you think this is a dream right now, you're mistaken. And you better not do that, because dream and waking are very, very different. Even though they're both empty of inherent nature, they are different. And we have to know that, otherwise we're a bit crazy, right? But that's this radical shift of perspective. Not viewing this reality from the perspective, even conventionally, of being a sentient being, but viewing it from the perspective of being someone who's lucid and sees this is a dream. From the perspective of Rigpa, this is a dream. It's not like a dream. I don't view phenomena as if they were dreams. This is a dream from this perspective. And it's only as if it were a dream from the perspective of a sentient being who is still, at least conventionally, identifying with a person that appears in the dream. Even if you know it's not inherently existent, still thinking, well, I'm not inherently existent, but at least, but this is conventionally who I am. This is where I stand. This is who I am. You have that choice. You can do that, and it's valid. And then you can use imagination and all the roundabout means to somehow break through. Or you can release that even conventionally. Total release. Into the non-duality of Rigpa and absolute space of phenomena. So from that perspective, it would be like being, again, in the midst of a lucid dream, totally lucid, and looking at all the people around you and all the phenomena around you and simply knowing none of this exists, not from the perspective of being awake. None of this exists at all from the perspective of one who's awake. Although for those who are in the dream and non-lucid, this is as real as it gets. So that's it for ultimate bodhicitta. Atisha gives us kind of like ontological shock therapy. Right after the four thoughts that turn the mind and developing some shamatha, optimally actually achieving shamatha, then takes us right into the depths, as we have seen. And now having drenched us in those depths and we absorb as much as we can, then he takes us to relative bodhicitta, and the rest of the teachings are all viewing within the context of relative or conventional reality. And how then, with this as much depth of insight as we can, how do we then, from this insight, some insight into the absence of inherent nature of all phenomena, now with that as your platform, your basis, now how do you transform, transmute everything that comes your way? That everything becomes, how do you say, is transformed into the path. Quite a brilliant strategy, I think. And that's Atisha. So tomorrow we'll go on to the practice of shamatha focus on the mind, according to the Penchen Rinpoche, Penchen Losan Chiki Gyantsen, who lived in the 17th century. And I did check, and Karma Lingpa, who discovered the treasure of Padmasambhava, he did indeed live in the 14th century. And so we have Atisha, who is regarded, I'm just now speaking within the context of Tibetan Buddhism, Atisha is regarded as the speech emanation of Padmasambhava. And the Penchen Rinpoche is regarded as incarnations of Atisha. And then we have the Dujum Lingpa mind treasures that are from Padmasambhava. So it's kind of Padmasambhava all the way through. You know, whether manifesting in Gelugpa style or pre-Tibetan Buddhist style, that is Indian Buddhism, Atisha, or Nyingma style, keeps on coming back to Padmasambhava. Can't get away from it, one way or another. And it's this speech emanation, the speech emanation. Sokye Dorje, the lake-born Vajra. So a strong connection there. All in the family, all in the same family. So that's it. Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning.